From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Spring, when nature flaunts her finest. Birds sing, trees erupt with blossoms that attract busy pollinators. Today we hear about ways to experience the flurry and bustle of the season. Ornithologist Bruce Beeler shares his insights on how to become a better or beginner birder. And environmentalist Colin Rees walks us through his book, Nature's Calendar, that chronicles four seasons at the Jug Bay Wildlife Sanctuary on the Patuxent River.
If I can describe a walk through woodland, it would be the equivalent of a green cathedral. Glossy vegetation, but you also have seeds and insects beginning to produce. You've got chorusing of frogs, you've got butterflies, butterflying, and the song. Above all, it's the song.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. We're in the throes of spring, when the outdoors offer witness to a riot of activity. Birds are migrating, flora stretching toward the sun, and insects buzzing to life again. Today we'll speak with two experts who can explain where to look for that activity and ways to better connect with it. Later in the show, we'll ask a bird expert how to attract feathered friends into urban yards and how to recognize them in the wild. Joining us now is naturalist and ornithologist Colin Rees, author of the recently published book Nature's Calendar, A Year in the Life of a Wildlife Sanctuary. A lifelong birder and natural scientist, Rees has devoted his career to conservation of the natural environment as a researcher and environmental consultant in the United Kingdom and the Philippines, and as a global biodiversity specialist with the World Bank. In Maryland, Rees has worked with state and national bird conservation nonprofits and is the steering committee chair of the Maryland Bird Conservation Partnership. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The Wildlife Sanctuary, in the title of your book, is Maryland's own Jug Bay. Describe where it is and what it is.
It's on the Patuxent River, some 20 miles southwest of Annapolis, and is one of the gems of Maryland. It has basically all the habitats and ecosystems that one could wish for in such a small place. And that includes freshwater marshes, swamps, woodlands, and grasslands, and also an agricultural landscape, which is being moved slowly in favor of conservation.
An agricultural landscape?
Agricultural landscapes are part and parcel of the reserve area, although that's relatively new, and the task is to make that more sensitive, if you like, to environmental needs.
So when people go there, I mean, what do they experience?
They can walk the many trails. I think there are about 15 to 20 miles of trails through these ecosystems at any time of the year. There is some sensitivity to the fact that it's a nature center or reserve, unlike the parks and recreation facilities that are offered in Anne Arundel County where the sanctuary is found. So there's a sense of trying to protect it as much as use it, perhaps as an area of recreation.
So in Nature's Calendar, you look at Jug Bay month by month.
Yes. Genesis really grew out of a book I had written earlier called Birds of a Feather, in which the concentration was on birds. And I felt, one, that I needed to take that further in terms of engaging all the wildlife, but also the fact it was closer to Annapolis, where I live, and allowed me to pay regular visits, which other times I would not be able to do so with larger landscapes.
Why did you want to take it further?
I wanted to deepen my appreciation in the entire landscape, not just birds. And I used birds as an entry point, basically, to look at flora and fauna through the seasons. And that meant looking at winter with its harsh conditions, spring with its resurgence, summer, the sort of fullness of the experience of walking through woodlands or marshlands, and then autumn with the sort of fruitfulness of the occasion, the preparations for winter. And I deliberately sought to use a diary form that could track me with some discipline through that process and engage what I saw, but also what researchers were conducting at the time, or volunteers in some of the climate change studies that they were undertaking.
You just connected the diary aspect of this book with discipline, but it's very personal also. Would you read to us from the passage dated April 16th?
Yes, I should say that it's wider than just April the 16th. It could well apply to conditions now. I call it, "In the Familiar We Find Surprises." Something about the fence post caught my attention, and instead of following the path winding through dark trees against the orchestral sweep of an open sky, I picked out an ensemble that gave much delight, moss, water, and tree rings. Many times I had passed this way, so what brought the fence post to my attention this time? Perhaps it was the showery light and made me notice smaller details, more circumspection, leavened by a gorgeous spring morning. Maybe the post was of Arabian stock and began decay earlier than its neighbors. Whatever the explanation, the microclimate, fungi, and microorganisms had gouged a hole sufficient to retain rainwater. Into this tiny pool had fallen seeds and leaves, and around it spread lawns of chartreuse green algae. A cushion of moss looked like a wood seen from above, with a tiny pool reflecting the morning sun. This is a fence post the colorful bluebirds will make joyous in summer, one from which the Carolina wren will offer a boisterous volley of song in winter. And then there are the woodpeckers.
You said that could describe what's going on now. What else is going on now in Jug Bay?
We're at one of the best times of the year. If I can describe a walk through woodland, it would be the equivalent of a green cathedral. Glossy vegetation. But you also have seeds and insects beginning to produce. And this is when migrants, of course, time their arrival in this part of the world so that they can take full advantage of an exhausting journey from the tropics. You've got chorusing of frogs, you've got butterflies, butterflying, and the song. Above all, it's the song that's beginning to erupt now in the form of the dawn chorus. It is an occasion when people can simply getting up early in the morning enjoy for a good period of this month, if not into well into June. It's really can be described as a symphony of the natural world.
And dawn is when you do a lot of your
observations?
Unfortunately,
this is where bird watchers, I'm afraid, are an interesting breed because they do have to get up early. And on this occasion, it would be about 5 o'clock in the morning. And of course, that gets earlier as the season progresses. But believe you me, it's worth it.
That's Colin Rees, birder and environmentalist, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, Nature's Calendar, A Year in the Life of a Wildlife Sanctuary. He's also co-author of Birds of a Feather, Seasonal Changes on Both Sides of the Atlantic. So you talked about some of what's going on. What's going on with the plants?
As I mentioned, they're now seeding. Their growth is so luxuriant, insects are beginning to bore into them and enjoy the nourishment that they obtain. But also they're providing a change of structure. They're hiding, for example, the area where birds might build their nests. And they're also providing shade, which to the extent that it's blocking out sunlight means a changing flora for woodland floor. In the marshland, with the growth of plants, spatterdock, iris, etc., beginning to express their structural forms, this again provides a means by which they can begin to lay their eggs, perhaps, or defend themselves. Otherwise, they would be exposed in the water column with no vegetation. So this is a natural hideaway, if you like, that they can use to avoid their predators.
You look at one year in Jug Bay, but you've been studying issues like this and paying attention for a long time. Is what you're observing now in Jug Bay happening earlier than it would have 10 years ago? In other words, what effect is climate change having on Jug Bay?
Yes, this is a theme of the book. It's the case not only of climate change in terms of temperature, but also water levels. And what I have observed, not just for the year the book was being written, and that was 2017, a noticeable increase in tidal levels has meant that waders that were part and parcel of the protected area are no longer present, or rarely so when there's an extremely low tide. It has also meant that some of the birds coming in from their migration from the south now face the prospect of either being caught out earlier or later with insect availability. And there's a risk, not just in Jug Bay, but through ecosystems in North America, where this is placing a lot of these birds at risk.
How should people use your book?
I think on two levels, just simply to enjoy, perhaps an occasion at bedtime. That's when people, I think, read diaries.
But you have to go to bed early to get up early to
observe.
That's
one of the casualties, I'm afraid, of being a birder. I think it relates to two things, as I said. The simple joy of being able to almost indirectly experience nature so that one comes to absorb what's around one almost casually. So it invites introspection. It also invites some connection, if you like, with nature. And that, to some extent, recharges batteries. It also reduces the load on our minds in this highly technological world. And I noticed, for example, in reading the literature, that neuroscientists, indeed in the medical profession, are saying, go out of doors, experience this, because it is a means to re-energize yourself.
And you said that's one goal.
One goal, and then was to report on the events. Those events allowed me to bring in science as an explanation for what's happening. But I found myself, interestingly enough, looking back at the early naturalists, those during Victorian times, who observed things more closely because they had no technical aids as we do now. And so their views were hardened, if you like, by the need to observe things more closely. And also I found it interesting and instructive to read poets of the time, Emily Dickinson in this country and William Wordsworth in the UK, because although they didn't adopt a scientific approach, nonetheless their observational powers and their ability to use the English language in a way that engaged reader had a very powerful effect on me.
It's a wonderful book. Thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Colin Rees is a British birder and environmentalist who lives in Annapolis. His book, Nature's Calendar, A Year in the Life of a Wildlife Sanctuary, describes Jug Bay on the Patuxent River. He'll be signing his book at the Maryland Ornithological Society's convention in Chestertown on June 1st. The convention runs from May 31st to June 2nd. We've got more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. A short break now, and then we'll ask a bird expert how to identify our feathered friends and how we can view them up close. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about ways to experience the natural world. Earlier, we spoke with birder and environmentalist Colin Rees about his book that chronicles a year of seasons at the Jug Bay Wildlife Sanctuary on the Patuxent River. Now we're turning to more urban settings and an overview of ornithologist Bruce Beeler's book, Birds of Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. It's an inviting coffee table book filled with full-color action shot images by Middleton Evans, with information about identifying birds, birding gear, viewing tips, and best ways to feed and find them. Beeler is also a research associate at the Bird Division of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. He's joining us by phone from somewhere in the middle of the continent, where he's been in pursuit of spotting migrating Hudsonian godwits. Thanks for pausing.
Isn't that a mouthful?
It is a mouthful. Thanks for joining us, Bruce. What is a Hudsonian godwit?
A Hudsonian godwit is an oversized sandpiper. More like a curlew, if some people might have heard of a curlew. Very few people will have heard of a godwit. It is a godwit because its long beak curls upward rather than downward or straight. So it's a glorious bird, rarely seen. Bird watchers lust after this bird. I've been seeing it every day. I've seen it 7 out of the last 8 days. I saw it this morning.
Where are you exactly?
At the moment, I'm where the bars are best. And I don't mean drinking bars. I mean bars for my phone.
Because we're talking to you on your cell phone. But
yes, we're very near Ruby, Nebraska, within a mile of Ruby.
And you've been where and you're going where and why?
good questions. So this is a way, a sort of a roundabout way of seeing America firsthand. So I'm following this bird, the Hudsonian godwit, from the Mexican border down near Brownsville, Texas, in the lower Rio Grande, up through the Great Plains, all the way across the United States. So that's Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota. Then I'm going to edge into Saskatchewan, Canada, and then end up in Manitoba. And I'm going to catch a plane at Winnipeg and fly up to Churchill, Manitoba, where this bird makes its nest.
You are obsessed.
Listen, this is like a birder's greatest holiday. I'm having a wonderful time, and I'm seeing a ton of birds, and I'm meeting a lot of people, and I'm seeing the country. So what more could you ask for?
How did you get so interested in birds?
Well, you know, it goes back to 1958. I saw a red-bellied woodpecker at Lake Rowland, but just a little bit north of Baltimore, with my family.
You were a kid.
I looked up. I was 7 years old, of course, in 1958, a little while ago. Dates me a little bit. I looked up into this tree from our picnic table, and there was this fantastic thing, this apparition, red, black, and white, zebra striped on the back with this red cowl on its head. And I just had to know what that bird was. And so I became initially, at age 7 and a half, a woodpeckerologist, and I was just obsessed by woodpeckers. And then I broadened, you know, we broadened out, and my brother Bill joined the fun instead of my mom and dad. So it all became, you know, a magnificent obsession.
How can people who live in the city increase their opportunities to see birds?
Well, you know, the first step is to actually become interested, because if you're not interested in seeing the birds, if you're not interested in the birds, they won't come to you. You just won't see them. They're there. They'll be singing, and you won't even notice that. So first, you know, get interested. Then often the next step is to put out a feeder. Even if you're in town, you can put out a feeder, a window feeder. You know, if you're in an apartment, if you're in the suburbs, you can put out a suet feeder that brings in the woodpeckers, or you could put out another feeder that has seed. The best seed, the seed that I recommend, is sunflower seeds. That attracts what I think are the best birds. Of course, that's a subjective opinion. So it starts with wanting to see the bird, then feeding the bird, and then, of course, you have to learn how to identify the bird. What is that bird you're seeing, that red bird? Oh, it's a northern cardinal, or maybe it's a white-throated sparrow if it's wintertime. So, you know, interest really leads down that path. Interest, feeding, looking, identifying.
Before we leave feeding, what you described, is that about how to lay out snacks for birds? Does that work with hummingbirds?
Believe it or not, it's one of the easiest things, because hummingbirds are happily attracted to a feeder that's nothing more than a glass vial that dispenses sugar water. And so it's you can buy one at a hardware store. You make the little mix of the sugar water. You can find that online. I think it's like 5-to-1 sugar to water. You put that out in the spring. You want to get that out by late April. And they will arrive in your yard, and they'll start coming into that feeder. And isn't that wonderful to see a hummingbird in your backyard? That's really something special.
So when you're paying attention to birds, are binoculars important?
I think binoculars are very important. You really want to be, feel like you're as close to the bird as possible, and you can see all those beautiful details. So a pair of binoculars is very important. And, unfortunately, there are lots and lots of kinds of binoculars. You can go onto a website offered by Cornell called All About Birds, and there's a binocular section there that'll give you some hints on buying binoculars. You know, when you're just starting, the best thing to do is borrow a pair from your aunt or your uncle, or your parents, or some other loved one, and just take them out and see how they feel. And then if you like them, then you can get another pair just like that. So, you know, they can be expensive. So, you want to be careful when you buy your first pair.
I've wondered about bird baths. I mean, do they really attract birds, or do they end up just being breeding pools for mosquitoes?
No, they're fabulous for the birds. You are doing a real service for the birds if you put out a bird bath. So, absolutely, put it in a protected area, sort of near the vegetation, not wide out in the right out in the open, but closer to some vegetation. One of the things we worry about in the Baltimore area is bird-eating hawks. Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned hawk, both of those birds are fantastic bird hunters. And, you know, you don't want to see that carnage in your backyard. It happens, and it's natural. It's fine. But if you put the feeders and the bird baths sort of close to the vegetation, not in the vegetation, just nearby, the birds have a chance. They can hide, you know, rush back to the vegetation if that wily Cooper's hawk shows up.
Hmm. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with ornithologist Bruce Beeler about his new book, Birds of Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia, with photography by Middleton Evans. So back to the question of bird identification. What are some good ways to learn how to do it?
Well, of course, practice makes perfect, and having a field guide. And that's not the book that that I wrote. A field guide is usually a small sort of a hand guide. It's usually 5x8 or thereabouts. And it focuses on helping you simply identify the birds. And there are a lot of them out there. The famous one is Roger Torrey Peterson's Field Guide to the Birds. That's a good one still. Chan Robbins, who was a local ornithological hero, he died sadly last year. He has a nice field guide. There's a National Geographic field guide that's excellent. It's a big one, and it's mainly for the experts, but anyone can use it. And then there's also the David Sibley guide. It's actually titled The Sibley Guide to Birds. And I recommend, if you get the Sibley guide, get the East version, Sibley East. Any of those field guides will be excellent for identifying birds.
In that context, in the context of identifying birds, what will this gorgeous book that you have published with Middleton Evans photographs, and some photographs by you also, what will that contribute to people being able to identify birds?
So, you know, this book is a useful companion to the field guide. It's got all the things that the field guide doesn't. So whereas the field guide will have painted illustrations of the birds, the paintings are really excellent helping people identify the bird. Our book has, you know, more than 500 photographs. And that gives you a feel of all the birds. And we do, in fact, have a little something of a mini field guide in the back of the book, about 100 pages in the back, that has a photograph of every species of bird known from Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. That's some 460 species, believe it or not. That's a lot of birds.
Wow.
With a little thumbnail description of where to find this bird and what season to look for it. So that'll help. And there's also in the front, for the beginner, there's a section that has a grouping of chapters. So it's groups of like the waterfowl or the herons and egrets or the sparrows and friends or the warblers. So you get a feel for the different kinds of birds that you can see if you go out bird watching.
Some people can recognize a bird just by its song. How does one get to that level?
That's an important thing. Birds make a lot of noise. They make music. Some of the sounds are not very musical, but some are absolutely glorious. If you actually want to practice learning, there's an app for your phone, or there's several apps. There are these field guides, like the Sibley Field Guide has an app that you can put on your phone, your smartphone, and it has all the songs. So it has a picture of the bird, it has some text about the bird, it has a map of where the bird lives and how it migrates, and then it has some samples of its songs and calls. And you know, if you hear a bird out in the field and don't know what it is, you can go to your app on your phone and play the song and say, aha, yes, that's what I'm hearing right now.
Is one season better than another to observe birds?
There's a lot of argument about this, but for me personally, subjectively, the spring is the best. It's the best because many of the songbirds, like the warblers and the vireos and the thrushes, and the orioles and the tanagers, the grosbeaks, the males have put on their most beautiful plumage, the most colorful feathers in the spring because they're getting ready to make a family. And this is when they sing the most, because they not only put on that plumage for the female to attract a mate, but they also do that singing to attract a mate. So in the spring, you sort of get all those bonus activities. You'll be seeing birds year-round, and bird watchers go out all the year round. But the spring is pretty special for most of us.
Bruce, thanks for sharing your obsession with us.
You're very welcome.
Ornithologist Bruce Beeler's impressive new book is Birds of Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia, with photography by Middleton Evans. At the end of next week, Saturday, June 1st, Evans will be signing books at the Maryland Ornithological Society's convention in Chestertown. The convention runs from May 31st to June 2nd. We've got information about that and other birding events at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. Tara Zarfashan is our intern. I'm your host, Sheila Cast. Thanks for sharing time with us on the Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.